So we're looking at tonight Esther chapter 2, and I read verse 1 again. After these things, when the wrath of King Ahasuerus was appeased, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what was decreed against her. We looked at chapter 1 last time, and we saw how providence prepared the way rather for a new queen, and now we're going to see tonight how providence opens the door for Esther to rise to this position of a queen. It all hinges on very little things, isn't it? Providence and the way things turn out. If the king hadn't made his request, there would have been no place for Esther. If Vashti had obeyed the king's commandment and come as he had requested, then these things in chapter 2 also wouldn't have happened. Or if the king Ahasuerus, instead of becoming angry and upset with Vashti for not coming, he could have laughed it off or just brushed it off, and then Vashti would have remained king. But he got angry, and he brought in this law, as we saw in our last study, that he listened to his counselors, and he brought in this law to say that Vashti should never come into the presence of the king ever again, and her royal estate should be given to another. So on very little things, it seems incidental, it seems so insignificant, turns the wheel of God, the providence of God. But just going back to that law that he made, it's a very proud law in a sense. It was said to be a law of the Persians and the Medes. Whenever the king made the law, well, he couldn't change it. He was as if he was speaking under inspiration, infallibly. His word cannot be changed. And it's a very proud thing in a sense to say, because he's human. He's only a man. And just like we have in our laws, the Prime Minister and his Cabinet Office, well, they come up with laws to implement, but it has to go before Parliament, and usually the opposition will see holes in it and will ask for amendments in it for it to be changed. But here we see this king, and the things as they were at that time, that if the king of Persia said something and it became law, then it couldn't be altered. But he's human. Only God's laws cannot be changed and cannot be altered. Anyway, that's by and by. But here in chapter 2, we resume with that now the wrath of King Ahasuerus, who we know is Xerxes in history, he was appeased. And the events of these chapter take place between 483 BC, when a feast of the chapter 1 was, and 479 BC, when Esther actually was chosen to be queen and elevated to that position. So 4 years transpire between the events of chapter 1 and the end of chapter 2. You might think it's a very long time, and it is, but in between, King Ahasuerus, Xerxes, he's gone out to battle. His father had started a battle with Greece, but he died before he could conquer them. And so Xerxes took up the position, and he sought to conquer the Greek states, but he failed. He lost. He's overconfident. Maybe he had other victories, but he lost this particular one. But in 481 BC is when he actually set out for the war, to undertake that war against the Grecian states, and didn't really return until 2 years later, 479 BC. So we see here how verse 1, King Ahasuerus, his anger subsides, and then he remembers, oh, what a mistake I made, how foolish I was, and he seems to regret the decision that he has come to, and the law that he has put in place that cannot be reversed. And he remembers Vashti, and it seems he almost desires, wishes he hadn't done what he did. And how often we learn that in life, isn't it? That when we do things out of anger and out of control, then later on we regret it. And so often we cannot undo, or we will try our best to undo what we've done. Sometimes we've said words we shouldn't have said when we are angry, or made decisions we shouldn't have made. And it's better rather to wait until we are calmer than in the hot heat of anger to decide things. But it's too late now, and he cannot reverse the decision. And we read here how when the king's servants saw him in this kind of a position, regretting that, well, they quickly suggested to him, let there be fair young virgins sought for the king, and gather these virgins from all around, from each of the 127 provinces. Let the most beautiful of these women be gathered together for the king. Send out your officers into all these provinces and get the best and the most beautiful fair young women, the fair young virgins, to Shushan the palace, and let the king choose one of these women to replace Queen Vashti. They probably said this for their own interests, the servants. Not that they really were concerned about the king, but they were afraid lest Vashti should be restored to her position, and then she would take vengeance on them. But here we see that women were to be brought from all across the regions, and they were to be placed under the care of Hegi or Hegai, we read later. Just to give a little bit of a description of the palace, there were three places. There was the main palace, there was a place there for three buildings, one for the queen and one for the king's concubines, which was under Shaskaz, we read in verse 14. And there was another place for the virgins under Hegai, who took care. So the plan was, gather all these virgins under Hegai, then let them go in to the king, and then they would transfer from there to the king's concubines under the jurisdiction, under the supervision rather, of Shaskaz. So this was the plan, to bring the most beautiful women from across the 127 provinces. But look at verse 4. The maiden which pleased the king, let her be queen instead of Vashti. And the thing pleased the king, and he did so. It pleased him. It was a suggestion, really, which catered to his lust. What's he doing? What's he doing taking all these women from their homes, these young girls from their homes and from their families and from their familiar environments, and bringing them into his palace, taking them from possibly good husbands that they could find where they are in their own families, coming to live as a concubine most likely in here in Shushan, and not have their own families? He was robbing them, in a sense, of all these things. But you read here, the thing pleased the king, and he did so. It appealed to him, it appealed to the baser instincts of his nature, and he desired to put into action these things. And it's the same, isn't it, today? Today people do as they please. Today people will think, well, as long as it doesn't do much harm, then we can go ahead and do it. I was talking to somebody in the open air, and he was saying exactly the same thing, and I'm sure you've heard it as well many times. Oh, as long as it doesn't do any harm to anybody, then we can indulge in our sexual lusts, or we can live how we like. We can live. What's wrong with living together without getting married? What's wrong with a man going with a man, or a woman going with a woman? There's nothing wrong with these things. It's not hurting anyone. It's not harming anyone. But that's, people are following not God's law. They're following their own desires, the things that pleases them. But here, what he was doing was actually harming a lot of people. And we have to say, friends, where there is no Bible, as there was no Bible here, no law of God, then people do as they like. People want to follow their own desires, their own base desires. I heard a story a long time ago of a homosexual actor, and a very famous actor as well. But whenever he would go into a hotel, he would, you know, where the Gideon's Bibles were located, he would pick up those Bibles, and he would look at Leviticus chapter 18, and he'd pull out the page, because he didn't like what he was saying. And every hotel he went in, this is what he would do. Well, he can do that, but he's not going to change God's law. But they don't like God's law, because it was against his likes and against his desires. But then we move on. We see in verse 5, we are now introduced for the first time to Mordecai and to Esther. In Shushan the palace, there was a certain Jew whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite who had been carried away from Jerusalem. And some commentators say that Jair is his father, Shimei is his grandfather, Kish is his great-grandfather, while others say, and most probably they're right, is that this is just identifying for us where Mordecai came from, where his tribe came from, that he was indeed a Benjamite. And they suggest that while Jair is his father, Shimei refers to the Shimei who cursed David. And Kish, as you know, was the father of Saul. But they were all from the tribe of Benjamin. So it's just showing to us that the line that Mordecai came from and descended from. And in verse 6, it's not referring to Mordecai who had been carried away, because it's now like 115, 120 years since that second taking of the people from their land in Israel, in Palestine. Verse 6, who had been carried away from Jerusalem with the captivity, which had been carried away with Jeconiah. That was the second carrying away, Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had carried away. So, probably around this time, again, the commentators reckon that Mordecai was about 30 to 40 years old. And we see in verse 7 that he brought up Hadassah, that is Esther, his uncle's daughter. So Esther is his cousin, and she is an orphan. She had neither father nor mother, but she was very beautiful. She was fair and beautiful. And we read, when Mordecai took her for his own daughter, because she was an orphan, a young orphan girl. He took her under his wings. Mordecai and Esther both are referring to Babylonian gods. Mordecai is a translation of the Marduk, Babylonian deity, and Esther is a form of Ishtar, which is the Babylonian goddess of love and war. And they probably did that for their own safety. They had their own Hebrew names. You see Esther's one here is Hadassah. But at that time, they sort of, the Jews kept a low profile, as we will see in a minute. But I want us just here to notice the care of Mordecai, how he stepped in. Yes, it was his duty, you could say, as a family member, to look after this orphan daughter, but he steps in very willingly. Most likely he had his own family, it doesn't say so, but most likely he had his own family, his own wife, his own children to look after, but he is willing still to take Esther under his care, and he treats her as his own daughter. Well, that would have been costly for him personally. It would have been an inconvenience to him, but he would also have taken time, as the text goes on to indicate to us, to suggest to us, that he also took the time to instruct her, to as well as to provide for her as a good father. Well, dear friends, application for us, that we mustn't neglect to extend help as well to the needy in the church family. We have a duty of care. Just as much as we feel for our blood families, we should have a similar sense of care for one another. And especially when we are in difficult situations, when one of our brothers or sisters is in a more difficult situation and needs extra help, then we step in, even though it may cost us some of our time, and it may cost us maybe even financially, but we want to try and help alleviate their suffering and to show personal concern and care. This is also part of our duty in loving one another. And then, going down to verse 8, so it came to pass, when the king's commandment and his decree was heard, and many maidens were gathered together unto Shushan the palace, to the custody of Hegai, that Esther was brought also unto the king's house, to the custody of Hegai, keeper of the women. The word here, brought, actually means seized, or grasping, as if you, when you seize or grasp a person, or you're grasping an animal. And it suggests that she was taken by force and unwillingly. Some say that Mordecai may even have tried to hide her, but unsuccessfully, as you can see. But she was taken, it seems, against her will by force. One commentator does suggest that she, Mordecai, may have had a premonition from the Spirit that he was to release her to the king. But the word brought is quite strong, and it seems to suggest it was involuntarily that she was taken. After all, Mordecai, looking after her as his own daughter, wouldn't want her to be subject to such treatment in the king's palace. But this is what happened. In verse 9, we see that the maiden, that is Esther, pleased the king. She found favor in his eyes, literally was good in his eyes, and she obtained kindness of him. This man, this chamberlain of the virgins, well, he seemed to notice something about Esther. Not only her beauty, it must have been, but the way she carried herself in comparison to all the other women. Maybe all the other women, I'm just thinking out loud here, imagining, maybe all the other women were a little bit proud of their beauty and demanded things, but she is of a different nature. She is of a gentle character, and she is of a winsome character alongside her beauty. Beauty is vain, the Bible says, but if it's alongside grace and a good character, well, that's even better, isn't it? Well, we see here how he, because she found favor in his sight, he treated her differently. He gave her 7 maidens, the best maidens. He gave her not only things that he should have given her, but even more for her purification and for her preparation. And he preferred her and even gave her the best place in the house of all the women. So early, Esther sees these things. And God, of course, is the one who has moved him to be so well disposed towards Esther. And Esther herself, well, she must have been wondering, what's happening to me? Why is he showing such favor to me? Why have I been taken? And why is such favor being shown to me? What is happening? She wouldn't be fully clear, but maybe she's beginning to see something. And providence also is like that. We don't see the end right at the beginning or midway through, but little by little, God unfolds his will and his plan. In verse 10, Esther had not showed her people nor her kindred, for Mordecai had charged her that she should not show it. She was not to reveal her identity, that she was from the Jews. They probably took her as a Persian because she was born in Shushan. But why? Why does Mordecai tell her not to reveal that she is Jewish? Most likely because the Jews and their religion was hated at that time. There were Jews who were monotheists, whereas the others were usually polytheists. They worshipped many gods. And the Jews said, no, there is only one God, one true God. And people hated the Jews because of that reason. But notice also here how Esther did as Mordecai had charged her. Even though now she is away from him, it's ingrained in her to obey, to listen to her senior. And all that Mordecai has input into her, all the teaching he has given her, all the help he has given her, has not been in vain. And it's an encouragement for her parents, where we shouldn't leave our kids, as it were, to ourselves, or leave them to the world. If we leave them to the world or to education these days, then they will turn out rotten. If we just leave them to themselves, we have to, friends, input into them. I remember hearing of a Chinese young lad. He was in his teens when I met him, but he said he grew up in a Christian family. But when he went to school, education turned him into an atheist and an evolutionist. And that's what education's out to do, to rob. And sadly, in so many cases, yes, there's so many good things by education, but sometimes the science side of it is out to rob our young children of even their faith and their belief in the Creator God. So what we sow to our children is never wasted. Mordecai, verse 11, walked every day before the court of the women's house to know how Esther did and what should become of her. Maybe he was a porter or a doorkeeper, or somebody, maybe he was even a little bit higher up, of a higher rank. We're not too sure, but he must have been a recognized person. Otherwise he'd be, there he is walking every day outside the court of the women's house. Well, if you imagine the women see him, well, what's this man every day walking up and down? He would be arrested in the UK if that was the case. So he must have had some permission to walk in that area. But every day, again, he's inquiring of her. And every day, friends, we should show, as it were, concern for our brethren. Mordecai is separated from Esther, but he doesn't stop caring. And even so for us, even after we are separated from one another, we shouldn't, by distance, we shouldn't allow that to affect our communications with one another. It's sad, isn't it? I think that in our digital age, when we have so much communication, and communication is so easy, that still we forget to communicate with people, and to, especially those we don't see, out of sight, out of mind, is what people say. But it shouldn't be with us as believers. We should have our brethren in our hearts. And then in verses 12 to 15, we see how these maidens, these virgins, were prepared, and such perfume was given to them, oil of myrrh, to make their skin smooth and soft, perfume to take away the unpleasant smell, the sweat from the heat. And we see the maidens could decide before they went into the king. Well, they could choose what jewelry they wanted to wear, what dress and attire they desired, the head attire it is all their own choice. And then after they've been into the king, they return back to the house of the concubines or secondary wives. And we see that with Esther's case, she didn't make any choice. She just left the choice of dress and attire to Hegai, and left everything in his hands. And we read that also in verse 15. At the end, Esther obtained favor in the sight of all them that looked upon her. Once again, something in her demeanor that seems to draw attention to herself in the right way. In verse 16 to 18, we see how Esther herself went into the king in the month Tebeth, that is 479 BC. It's December, mid-December to mid-January that month. And the king, verse 17, loved Esther above all the women, and she obtained grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins, so that he set the royal crown upon her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. And then the king made a great feast for her and gave gifts according to the state of the king. So Esther is raised to this position. Three times we are told that she finds favor. She found favor with Hegai. She found favor with all the people that looked upon her, verse 15. And then verse 17, she found favor above all the women with the king and obtained grace and favor in his sight. Was it her own doing? Of course not. It is the Lord's doing that even people found favor in, that she found favor in their eyes. But it's not just to lift up Esther. It's not just to puff her up and to make her think she's great and she's wonderful. It's for a reason. It's for a purpose that she has been brought to this position, as she will soon find out. And it's the same with us. Wherever the Lord may give us favor in the eyes of our manager, or in the eyes of our employers, or in some other way, it's always for a reason, a purpose, so that we may be instrumental in his kingdom, and we may reach somebody with the gospel. He places us, whatever position, whether we're high up, whether we're doing a lower job, it's that we're put there providentially by God for a reason and a purpose that will become clear to us, but especially to be a witness for him, to stand up for him, as Esther would have to do very soon. But I just close with this one point. Esther was exalted to be queen to save the Jews. When that edict would come to destroy them, she would stand in the gap. She was elevated to that position for that reason. But in order to save his elect, the Lord Jesus Christ had to descend. He didn't come as a king. He came as a servant. He died in humiliation. He died as if he was a criminal. People thought he was a criminal. But he died in weakness, apparent weakness. But through his humiliation, through the cross, through his suffering, he has intervened to save his elect people. He went down so that we could go up, so that we could be rescued and saved from eternal damnation. And all how much we owe to him for what he has, for his interception, for his intervening to save us from such a destiny.